Hello, welcome to you. You're listening to Beck Wilson and this is my podcast series, Art Vox. You can find us on iTunes or at RebeccaWilsonArt.com. Today I'm talking to June August. She's an American artist who I met at the Parallax Art Fair in London, where she was exhibiting large silkscreen works. You can find out more about June and her work at SaatchiArt.com/June August. June has an MFA from the School of the Museum of Fine Arts, or Tufts University in Boston. She has works in the permanent collection of the Museum of Fine Arts, also in Boston. She was a research fellow in Tokyo at the National University of Fine Arts for 1 year and has been part of the artist residencies at the Cité International des Arts in Paris on a number of occasions. She's also exhibited widely for many years. We chatted about the themes behind some of June's works and how her international practice has influenced her work and the processes behind it. Women are central to much of June's work, and a particular favourite of mine was her work Oval Office and Justice. In that work we see a proud Frida Kahlo, a Mexican woman obviously, in the White House, and I thought it was a very sharp political comment, and her works are very colourful, vibrant and clever. It was great to chat with June about her work, and you can see more of her work this February, the 16th and 17th, at the Kensington Town Hall as part of the Parallax Art Fair. I'm speaking to June August. Hello, June.
Hello, Beck. Yeah, it's nice to meet you here, and we were just sharing some adventures that we'd had in the past in China.
It's been really lovely to meet you and have a chat, and I really love your work.
Thank you.
I was very excited to have a chat with you about it. Would you like to explain for people who are listening what your work is that's on display here today?
Well, I thought, since I'm an American artist exhibiting in London, I would like to show work that was a little bit about my country, because I thought if people are coming from different countries, maybe in their work it would tell a little bit of story of their country. So I have one picture that has the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and with some wildlife around it. And then I have one with Thelma and Louise. I mean, the titles are different, but the subject matters, because I often make work about women. I'm interested in equal rights for women, so my art often features women or women's connections. For example, here with the Native American and the horse, it's with the Native American celebrating the Native American woman, again, word woman, and the connection with nature by her close contact. And the title is Horse Kiss, and their noses are almost touching. And then I have the Oval Office in the White House. I made this 1 month after I was in the Women's March in Boston in 2017. And mean things had been said about our neighbors, the Mexicans. And so I put Frida Kahlo dressed all in pink, because that was the color of the Women's March, in the Oval Office. And she just has almost a tear in her eye. And she's there with a few of her parrot friends, almost like counseling her. And it shows a connection with nature, but it also shows that, you know, I put a Mexican woman in the White House.
It's one of my favorite works that you have on display, and it's actually very powerful. But initially, to look at it, it's a very beautiful image, so people may not necessarily make the political connection immediately, which I like about it.
I think here maybe some people wouldn't so much, but in America we're so familiar with the word Oval Office. Every day on the news you hear the word Oval Office, and they almost use that word more than White House. I mean, you know, like different governments have their terms that the public recognizes in the media. So over in the U.S. they just say, oh, in the Oval Office something happened or was signed today or something. So I thought if I use the Oval Office itself, that would really make a statement. And I like bright colors, and I reference Liechtenstein and I reference Warhol. So anyway, the Horse Kiss was also featured in the Boston Globe in May. It was for the weekend of May 6th, it was the featured artwork, and they recommended that people go to the exhibition. It was called The Shaman Show. It was in Rockport, Massachusetts. And I made this work specifically for the show. The people had asked me several months ahead, and they'd said, you know, it was about this shamanism, and I really didn't know what that was, but I remembered when I was little, I liked to read about Native Americans. They were my heroes. I wanted to be one. And so I said, well, on this subject, could I make something with Native Americans? Would that apply to your topic of your show? And they said yes, so that's why I made The Horse Kiss, and I made it in many variations. I like to work a little bit like Warhol in that way, that I like to make something, but then I make it in different colors and things like that.
Now, yesterday when we were chatting, you were talking about your experience in Japan and how that's influenced your approach. And I'm just looking at this work that was featured in the Boston Globe, and I think that's a really good example of what you were talking about. Would you like to explain a bit about the brush marks and the effect of being in Japan?
Yeah, well, I was very, very lucky. I went to Tufts University in Boston, and they had a connection with Tokyo Gaidai, Tokyo National University of the Arts. And I don't know if I was the first one or it was somebody's idea, but the head of the printmaking department said, did I feel like traveling for a year? And he said he would recommend me if I wanted to have a residency abroad. And he said, how about Tokyo? And I said, well, I had never even thought of it. But yeah. So they did all the paperwork at the university, and it was a research fellowship, so I didn't have to pay anything to go to the university. And I had the, the National Treasurer of Japan, Tetsuya Noda, was my sensei for the year. And it was an honor, but I was so naive. I didn't realize so much at first that I was receiving this honor. But after I got there, everyone that was in Japan told me. So then I knew. But I did learn a lot how important the mark making is. I had even before in life felt important in mark making and drawing and different things. But somehow in Japan, it was more distilled. The mark making was a kind of calligraphy, but it could also be a calligraphy.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are now opening our doors, so please expect the public to come through. Please make sure everything, all your personal items are out of sight. We're now opening the doors. Thank you.
I'm going to grab my purse.
Oh, yeah.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're now opening the doors. Please make sure your personal items are out of sight. And enjoy your day. Thank you.
Sorry.
It's not yours.
I think that I really started thinking more about the calligraphy of the brush strokes being a kind of language. And so when I'm working that way, I often do a lot of editing because I want each mark to have, a special force or a special meaning. It's not like the marks are so random. I try to make them look random, but it's also with a little bit of calculation.
There's a consideration.
Yeah, and also, I just think if you put, I am just the opposite of a lot of printmakers I know, but I like their work. I'm not saying that, but I think less is more. I think it makes a more clear statement to not be cluttered with lots of lines and extraneous details. So I prefer to simplify my colors and even simplify my lines.
So that obviously had a big impact on your, the way
you work. Very big. In fact, for years afterward, my work looked very Japanese. Even here in this work by the at the Museum of Fine Arts that I did in red, yellow, and blue for the Museum Variations, you'll see a big dragon that's from Murakami, because in Boston last winter we had a Murakami exhibition, and he had lots of dragons in his work. And also the museum has a huge Japanese collection, I think the biggest in America.
Wow.
And so they put a lot of their own works that they had in there, they own next to Murakami's works to, make a comparison between old and newer Japanese style works.
Great.
Yeah, it was. And I love the Canada geese that live outside in the summer of the MFA, so I put a lot of them in. And the tourists and people, everyone loves them because they're so cute and they like to be photographed. But the police don't like them because they always walk across the road when people are driving their cars. So I had to make a statement to protect the geese. Just like I make a statement about women, to protect women, But this was the one they chose for the show. It's a little earlier work. I made it in 2015. And it was about art and justice. And I was thinking This one collector in Genk, Belgium, he said he was going to have a show about art and justice, but each of the artists that he notified that he would pay, you know, for your work, he said, you can choose to make whatever you want. But since I'm making silkscreen, I made that. But I was thinking that she is almost like the goddess, the Greek goddess, and I would think she would stand for justice. And then in the one that I made with, I don't think I have it here, but the one I made for the show in Belgium had the word art from a Liechtenstein.
And using the same female figure, so
right,
she's Olympus, because, or...
Yeah, I signed up her as Justice, because he wanted something about art and justice. So I thought this would be the art, and then she would be the justice, you know. But you can see that goes with my style, where I take off on a certain direction, like with the horse kiss, but then it has lots of variations, even in the line, you know.
Mm. And we should explain to people who can't see your work that it's actually a really large work, so that that, in terms of producing screen prints of that scale, do you want to talk a little bit about the process and just how much is involved in that?
Well, it's very hard to describe in words. I hope if anyone's really interested, they'll go to their local print studio collective or something. But in Europe, you have these big print collectives and some other kinds of art collectives. But in U.S., we have some, but they're more privately owned, so they're much smaller. And we don't have those big vacuum silk screen presses available to people like me anywhere in the U.S. But over here, I can go to a studio and ask them and maybe, you know, pay for some month's time or something to use it. So that's what I do. I come over to the UK. I had a visiting artist grant to Ireland, and I learned about this machine and about silkscreen that I like to do like this. And since then, I've come over at least once or twice a year to make my silkscreens. But it's a process where it's a big screen. It's almost like a frame of a picture. And then it has a filament kind of fabric, very fine fabric, stretched tightly over it. And then I coat that with a photographic emulsion. So it's really a photographic process. The screen becomes light sensitive. Then I put my image on a big exposure box that has UV lights. I put my screen face down with the photo emulsion on top. I cover it with a vacuum, and then I push the button for the light exposure, and depending on the light exposure, what kind of image you collect. Then afterwards, I take it to another room that has a hose that's like a car wash hose, and I blast it, and the areas that were not exposed to the light, the areas where the drawing wire or the image shape, that gets blasted out. And then the hard part is the stencil that is the photo emulsion gotten hot and hard. And then I take it to a press that's a vacuum press that holds it really tight when I push the button for the vacuum to suction the paper down. And that's very important to my work, because I don't just go over the color like red for this horse's kiss once. I usually go over maybe five times to make it a really strong, bright color. And if the paper moved even the tiniest bit, it would ruin my work. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to come to Europe and make these prints over here, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I just layer it on, like, you know, another screen would have maybe the black drawing lines, another screen would have the gray lines in the background or something. Mm-hmm. As I told you, I have some associations with the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and they helped me get that fellowship to Japan. But they also do other things for me every once in a while. Like, I was framing my work in black because I belong to a printmakers group called Boston Printmakers, and I noticed that they're... standard is everybody has these narrow black frames. So I just did that too, without thinking. And then someone who actually works at the MFA as a curator said, you know, I just want to talk to you, June, for a minute, but your work with these big, powerful silk screens, you shouldn't have black frames. You should have white frames. He said, come over to the museum and look at our collection hanging up, and you will see white frames. Switch over to white frames, please. So since then, I've used white frames. And also, on the framer where I go to, he said, you know, you always crop your paper right to the edge where the image starts. He said, if you want to show that it's really a silk screen and it's a unique work, you should let some of the mark making of the silk screen actually show, like maybe where a squeegee touched an edge or maybe where some paint splattered or something. He said, don't cut that out and cover it up with a frame. Leave that as part of the whole image. And so I've done that since then. Silkscreen is so popular. Like, I've been printing at Edinburgh Printmakers now since 2010, and it's the most popular one, and it's a fight every every couple of weeks to get your sessions on screen. Everybody wants to book the presses, and there are not enough presses. And maybe a few hard feelings here and there because, you know, somebody got to the online to sign up for a session before somebody else or something. So you can see that it is not a dying medium. I think what it is you have to have that equipment.
Yeah.
So like in Scotland, yeah, there's Edinburgh, there's Dundee, there's Glasgow. I think maybe Aberdeen. There are several places they have big print shops with really massive equipment, and those places are packed. It depends. It really depends on where you are and what you have available. Because for silkscreen, you need that equipment. You can't just do it like a drawing or something. I mean, that's part of the preparation, but final work, you have to have these massive vacuum presses. So, and I think that started in Europe or maybe in UK.
Those facilities would not be as readily available in Australia, that's for sure.
No, nor in US. In US, like in Boston, Boston's kind of an academic city. We have a lot of universities. It's supposed to have most universities of a city in the U.S. And I think that typifies why we have certain things going on. And there are printmaking studios in the colleges, and lots of people have this practice, and I did too when I had my full-time job to support myself as an artist. I would take a printmaking course, and then whenever the studio was free or on Saturday when the course occurred, I could use the equipment, you know.
Yeah.
But really with printmaking, you need that equipment. And, you know, it would be very lonely if you had a press in your basement or something. And also,
it keeps you social.
It would be. And also, if you just have a few people come in, lots of times people don't take care of the equipment, and you have to be the big boss, and you have ministry. So it's nice if there's a community studio. And in Boston, there is one community studio, but they don't have very big equipment. You know, I think they can't afford it. Because in Europe, well, I don't know everywhere in Europe, but I know, like, in Belgium, for example, they have big printmaking workshops. And the government pays for the building, the government pays for the staff. In U.S., we don't have that. If you wanted to have a studio, you yourself would have to pay for the staff. You yourself would have to pay for the building. You yourself would have to pay for the equipment. So that's why we don't have it.
But, you know, that's actually surprising to me, because I always make the comparison between Australia and America in terms of there's a real culture of patronage and philanthropy in America, and we don't seem to have it so much in Australia. But so it seems like what you're saying too is that the government really puts their money where their mouth is in Europe in terms of supporting artists and that industry.
Yeah, and also for residencies. We have residencies in the U.S. too that are quite good, but some of the really powerful ones are the ones in Europe. They've been there for maybe 30 years or something. Like, I went to the Cité International des Arts just by accident and talked to the president just by chance, and she took me in, and I was able to print there, and I printed there for many, many years. And it was like a home to me. I felt like that was my home. I would come there every summer because I had to work hard all year. But every summer, as soon as my job was done, I was a teacher, I would get on the plane and head for Paris, and I would get a residency, so I'd have a place to live in the building, you know, and there would be a print studio in a building nearby, and it just seemed like the perfect answer in my life. And it was in Europe. I think in the U.S. we might have a few things like that, but maybe then there wouldn't be a place for you to live there. But in Europe, there was the place, like in Belgium too, at that France Masseriel. You have your own little house, you have your own little kitchen. There's just a short few steps away is the studio, you know. And
they've really thought of everything, haven't they?
They even have bicycles, you know, in Belgium at the studio. I can't ride a bike because I don't balance, but I walked to town, but everybody else took the bike, and they could get their soup, you know, groceries.
Yeah,
and things like that.
Yeah.
And I just thought, and also people treated artists with a lot of kindness there, as if they were kind of like a treasure. Whereas in, I think, maybe not everybody, but in U.S., I think lots of times people think of artists as maybe somebody that's not like them. And that's, it doesn't feel very as welcoming, you know what I mean, as if is something to worry about if you're an artist. And usually artists are very nice people, actually, like yourself, Beck. So, you know, it feels nice just to be in Europe and be where you feel more appreciated as a human being, too.
Yeah.
I think you can make better work sometime when you're a bit happier.
But the feeling that you're talking about in America of being an artist, I could say, probably exists in Australia, too. It's kind of an us and them, in a way, you know, like there's the sense of the other. And I would argue, too, that perhaps if you said to Australians, okay, we need to cut funding, do we cut military funding or do we cut the arts? I think a lot of people would say cut the arts because they're maybe not valued in the same way, which sounds like what you're saying.
It's exactly the same in the U.S., like right now, especially with the current politics that's going on. They're cutting the arts. Even my job, I was an art teacher in a public school. I had, you know, everything that a public school teacher would have, a permanent job, you know, Social Security, pension, all those things that you put money into. They cut my job because they thought that they didn't want to spend the money on my salary and my health insurance, they said. That's what my principal told me. The timing was good. It was very... I was upset because I wasn't expecting it to happen. And it took a few months to, you know, just pull it all together. But then I realized, wow, now I have my pension. Now I have my Social Security. And I never even thought of that. All the other teachers were counting each year how much more money they were going to get in Social Security. I never thought of it. I just thought I was going to teach for the rest of my life. And I enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah, you loved it.
I loved it.
I was just thinking it might be interesting, too, just to talk about how, since you were relating to your teaching, how that the exercise that you created led to your Frida Kahlo work.
All right, you know, it was an art lesson that I developed for the kids to become more aware of the American elections. So I referenced the 1992 perhaps, Roy Lichtenstein, where he did the Oval Office with the yellow curtains and the president's desk and a few chairs and paintings and maybe another flag or so. And finally, I'd say, you know, before we're going to color this, we have to think who's going to be president. Now, your parents are going to vote for, you know, their choice. I said, but in art, I want you to be president. So I think that I want this to be a self-portrait lesson, and I want you to draw yourself as president of the United States in the office using your best drawing skills, and I will help you. You know, and I showed them how to break face with the midpoint, the nose, and the eyes or whatever. And we did the face step by step, and then I let them do the clothing how they want, you know. It was amazing. Each one was a masterpiece. Either they didn't all look alike. None of them looked alike. I mean, they colored them with oil pastel and things, you know, for bright colors. And, you know, I did that for maybe 3 or 4 elections. And then last year I was in the Women's March in Boston. 1 month after we had had the Women's March, I had a chance to go to Edinburgh and make this silkscreen. And I was really, one of the security guards said he wanted me to make a work about American football, so I did that first. But I was really wanting to do this image that I had actually taught the kids for years, the Oval Office. And our about-to-be president, when we did the march, was very negative toward our neighbors, Mexicans, and said really mean things about them being all kinds of illegal-type people doing illegal acts. So I felt bad. So I put Frida Kahlo, dressed in pink, in the Oval Office, very large, very prominent. And she has just a sort of... you know, it's a non-committal look on her face, maybe a little tear in one eye, but it's barely, you barely can tell that it is. And she has some parrots, 4 parrots kind of counseling her, you know, as if they're part of Congress or something. And I thought this is a message because it's pink, like the week we have to wear in the Women's March. And also, it's a Mexican in the White House, and also it's a woman. So I just thought, thank you, art lesson, for that I taught for the last 12 years. It finally came through for me.
And we were talking yesterday when you were explaining that too about it, it just would not have possibly had the same poignance if you'd done it any other time.
Absolutely. I never would have thought of it because when I was having the kids draw themselves there, I didn't think of putting the real president there or something. I was just thinking, how could I make a lesson that the kids would relate to what was going on in politics with themselves? And maybe that they, girl or boy, could be president someday. I just thought I'd put all that together. But it's funny how something just rustles around in the back of your mind. It probably, I had forgotten I'd done that lesson, you know. And then suddenly I thought, you know, I just got the idea to do it. But somehow it had all been there because for years I'd been teaching that lesson, you know.
Yeah, just brewing in the back there. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm very happy with it, and many people like it. And it was chosen for a big exhibition in California now at the Brand. It's called Brand 46. It's a big library and art museum, and it's going to open on September 8th.
That's probably a nice way to wrap up.
Yes.
And June, it's been really lovely to meet you and
Beck,
to chat with you.
Maybe we should keep in touch somehow.
Absolutely.
You have my information, and maybe I can get yours. Okay, you can send me yours online.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Yeah. Oh, this is a pleasure.
So thank you.
It was fun talking about my work too. Thank you, Beck.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay,
I'm so glad that we got to meet. That's great.
Nice to meet you, and good luck with your work.
I hope you enjoyed that chat with American artist June August at the Parallax Art Fair last year. That was 2018. She'll be there again this February 16th and 17th at the Kensington Town Hall. And the exhibition at Brand 46 that she referred to in September was actually for last year, 2018. You could probably find that online somewhere. If you'd like to find June August, you can have a look at her work at saarchiart.com/June August. She also has a Facebook page. A quick thank you to Nigel Nick's Nowth Music for the jingle at the beginning and the end of this recording. And until next time, thanks for listening.